On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Democrats kick-started the New Hampshire presidential primary season last night with a live two-hour debate on CNN. Eight presidential contenders standing shoulder-to-shoulder on stage, throwing elbows, but in agreement that George Bush's America must change. Frontrunner Senator Hillary Clinton took the high road on solidarity.
The differences among us are minor. The differences between us and the Republicans are major.
Senator Barack Obama went after President Bush.
But the fact of the matter is that we live in a more dangerous world, not a less dangerous world, partly as a consequence of this president's actions.
And a revved up Senator Joe Biden hammered home that same point.
Let me tell you straight up the truth. The truth of the matter is, the only one that's emboldened the enemy has been George Bush by his policies, not us funding the war.
The war was everywhere last night, but healthcare and immigration and a whole lot of political theater showed up too. This hour On Point will roll the tape, listen in, and ask who's got the winning answers and the winning way as the Democrats debate. Joining me first today from Concord, New Hampshire, is Dan Baltz, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. He was at last night's Democratic presidential debate in Manchester, New Hampshire. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So what was the tone, the mood, the energy in that room last night, Dan?
Well, there was a lot of energy in this debate. I thought considerably more than the first debate in South Carolina back in late April. It was clear that a number of the candidates see this campaign moving quickly. They are trying to take advantage or gain advantage of their positions. One thing that struck me, Tom, last night was that in contrast to the first debate, which I thought had a kind of a leveling effect, which reminded people that the so-called second-tier candidates, Joe Biden and Bill Richardson and Chris Dodd, are quite substantial political figures in their own right, that last night's debate tended to re-separate the field, that I think that the focus, both in the way the questions were presented in the staging of it and in the exchanges, highlighted that this is a contest at this point that is more about Senators Clinton and Obama and former Senator Edwards than the other three.
Part of that by design, those three standing and then seated right in the middle of the stage, and that reflecting the latest poll numbers that you've got with ABC. Can you remind us of those, Dan?
Well, yes. The latest poll that we got back over the weekend has Senator Clinton leading by a fairly decent margin. She was at 42%. Barack Obama was at 27%. John Edwards was well back in the teens, and nobody else of the field was above 2%. So at this point, there is a clear hierarchy. We have to remind people, as we always do, it's still only June of 2007. There are a lot of voters who they're clearly paying attention, but they're not yet ready to make up their mind. So a lot can happen in this. But at this point, there is some obvious structure to the race.
Dan, what about those three front runners then and the dynamic of their jostling last night? How did you see that?
Well, it was interesting. John Edwards has for some months been, in essence, kind of calling out Senator Clinton and to some extent Senator Obama on the issue of the war. He has pressed those in Congress to be bolder, to be more aggressive in challenging Bush. He said that had he been in Congress, he would have preferred to see them send back a funding bill with another timetable in it. Last night, what he did was he challenged Senators Clinton and Obama not because they voted against that funding bill, but because they hadn't said they were going to do so in advance, that they waited until the last minute. As he said, they went quietly onto the Senate floor and cast their vote. And he said there is a difference between doing the right thing and leading. And these are people who want to be president of the United States, and they ought to be leading. What was interesting also, Tom, I thought, was the way Obama and Clinton handled that. Obama, who, as he reminds people at every stop, opposed the Iraq War from the beginning, said to Senator Edwards, "Now look, I was against this war. You supported it, so I think you're about four and a half years late in coming to the issue of leadership." Senator Clinton did not engage directly. She was throughout the debate, I think, seeking to avoid direct conflict and confrontation. trying, as frontrunners often do, to minimize differences and to keep the focus on her as somebody who has experience and readiness to be president.
Dan, we've got, of course, back-to-back debates this week with the GOP debating midweek in New Hampshire. How important are debates at this point in this very long presidential campaign season?
I think, frankly, they're of only small importance. They give some clues to activists. I think they begin to air out some of the differences that may exist among the candidates. The reality is the audiences for these debates are still pretty small. And as I said, that people are watching, but they're watching mostly in a kind of window shopping way, not in a kind of way they will begin to look at these candidates come November, December, or January as we're on top of the voting.
Dan Baltz, we appreciate your words straight there from New Hampshire in the hall last night as the eight Democrats stepped up. What did you think of CNN's staging and management of this debate, Dan?
I thought they did a very good job. I thought in particular the first hour of the debate was very good. I thought they were able to touch on some very important issues, some big issues, health care, for example, which got a pretty good airing. I am a big fan, normally, of town hall kinds of events, and I think that the voters' questions, particularly here in New Hampshire, are often really, really good. I didn't think that the second half of the debate had as much energy or value as the first half of the debate, but that's a minor quibble. I thought CNN in general did a very good job.
All in all, a pretty good show and pretty illuminating. Dan Baltz was there, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Dan, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We're going to dive in on everything we heard last night with some real great analysts in just a moment. Let's go first to some of the tape from last night, though. Here, CNN moderator Wolf Blitzer and former Senator John Edwards go back and forth. Edwards criticizes Senators Obama and Clinton for failing to show leadership, he says, on the issue of the Iraq War spending bill.
I said throughout the lead up to this vote that I was against a funding bill that did not have a timetable for withdrawal, that it was critical for the Congress to stand firm. They were given a mandate by the American people. And others on this stage, Chris Dodd spoke out very loudly and clearly, but I want to finish this. Others did not. Others were quiet. They went quietly to the floor of the Senate, cast the right vote, but there is a difference between leadership and legislation.
You want to name names?
No, I think it's obvious who I'm talking about.
It is to me, but it might not be to some of the
viewers. Senator Clinton and Senator Obama did not say anything about how they were going to vote until they appeared on the floor of the Senate, voted. They were among the last people to vote. And I think that the importance of this is, they cast the right vote, and I applaud them for that. But the importance of this is, they're asking to be President of the United States. And there is a difference between making clear, speaking to your followers, speaking to the American people about what you believe needs to be done. And I think all of us have a responsibility to lead on these issues.
Do you want to name names? Oh, no. Oh, twist my arm, and out it comes. John Edwards saying, not enough leadership from Obama and Clinton on Iraq. We're going to really look at this tape and listen in this hour. Joining us to do that from Washington is Ron Brownstein, national affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. His new book is The Second Civil War. Ron Brownstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Also with us from New York, Eleanor Clift, contributing editor for Newsweek. Her column, Capital Letter, posted every Friday on Newsweek.com and MSNBC. Eleanor, wonderful to have you.
Glad to be with you, but I'm in Washington.
Oh, good. Okay, I'll try and keep that straight.
And
Jack Beatty joins us, On Point News analyst, senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here.
And I'm in New Hampshire. Hi,
all right.
Tom and Ron.
In New Hampshire itself. We just heard Edwards go after Obama and Clinton right there. Before the break, I want to hear them respond and then get you all on the record. Here's Barack Obama coming back first at Senator Edwards' claim that he's not showing enough leadership on the Iraq War. He also discusses Senator Joe Biden's decision to vote for the Iraq War spending bill.
I think it is important to lead. And I think, John, the fact is that I opposed this war from the start. So you were about 4.5 years late on leadership on this issue. I think it's important not to play politics on something that is as critical and as difficult as this. Now, the fact of the matter is, Joe has a legitimate perspective. It is not easy to vote for cutting off funding because the fact is there are troops on the ground. I'll let Hillary speak for herself, but the fact of the matter is that all of us exercised our best judgment, just as we exercised our best judgment to authorize or not authorize this war.
There's Senator Barack Obama on Edwards' attack on Iraq. Here, Senator Hillary Clinton talks about what she would do differently as president in handling the situation in Iraq.
This is George Bush's war. He is responsible for this war. He started the war. He mismanaged the war. He escalated the war. And he refuses to end the war. And what we are trying to do, whether it's by speaking out from the outside or working and casting votes that actually make a difference from the inside, we are trying to end the war. And each of us has made that very clear. We have different approaches. I have a three-step plan to bring the troops home starting now, put pressure on the Iraqi government to take responsibility and cut off aid when they won't, and engage in intensive diplomacy regionally and internationally. The differences among us are minor. The differences between us and the Republicans are major.
Hillary Clinton last night on the war. Ron Brownstein, war at the beginning of this thing. Did Edwards' attack leave a dent on Clinton or Obama or give them a chance to stand up and shine?
Well, I think it's a pretty thin space he's trying to squeeze through here. The evolution of this debate has pulled all of the Democrats toward a more confrontational position on the war than seemed possible a year ago, even during the 2006 campaign. And so when he is out there saying, in effect, yes, they did vote the right way, but they didn't make enough noise about it, there's an audience for that. And I think there's an audience for the argument in particular on the original vote that Hillary Clinton cast and will not portray now as a mistake. There is an audience in the Democratic Party for that, but I don't think it is ultimately a decisive audience. You know, this debate, one of the most interesting things about this debate was the opportunity it gives us to see what the basic strategy is of the leading candidates. And in John Edwards' case, it reminds me of Samuel Gompers, the pioneering labor leader, reduced his agenda to a single word, more.
We're talking this hour about the Democrats in debate, all eight on stage last night in New Hampshire, Clinton, Obama, Edwards, and the whole crew of contenders for the White House mixing it up. Here, Senator Joe Biden last night says he won't criticize other Democrats who voted against funding for the war in Iraq, even though he has a different opinion.
I respect them, but look, I cannot. As long as there is a single troop in Iraq, that I know if I take action by funding them, I increase the prospect they'll live or not be injured. I cannot and will not vote no to fund them.
Senator Joe Biden last night. Eleanor Clift, what did you see up on that stage? What did you see unfolding here?
Well, I thought the three leading Democrats, and then I would add Joe Biden, I thought they all came across as strong and credible. Hillary maintained her lead. I kept thinking she is really a pro at this. Her answers were polished. She avoided all the traps. She played it safe. And Obama seemed so comfortable within his own skin. You never see sort of a forced smile or a gesture that seems practiced. He seems, you know, just so natural. And then I thought Edwards was more aggressive than he was in the last debate, and he needed to be. He, of course, served up the perfect line to Obama to come back at him about lack of leadership, saying he's 4.5 years too late. But, you know, I think if you're an Iowa voter, and for Edwards, it's all about Iowa, he's got to appear more anti-war, more progressive, appealing to the voters in Iowa.
Jack, how about it? CNN had those three right in the center of the crew, which put the focus on them physically, in addition to what the poll numbers say. Overall, what did you think last night? Are those three pulling away? Are others still in this debate? How's the field look?
I was struck with Obama's relatively weak performance. I mean, his main theme is it's time for a change. It's going to be a change election. I'm a new generation. Let's put the 60s and all their obsessions behind us and move on. He didn't get his theme out. And his answers, it seemed to me, again and again, seemed to be tentative and, in general, unfired. As for Hillary, you know, the New York Times Magazine runs a piece that day pointing out how political, that is, how driven by her career agenda her vote for the Iraq War was. And I think she made a similarly political statement about possible confrontation with Iran when she said it was absolutely unacceptable that Iran should have nuclear weapons, which is exactly what the Republicans say. She's legitimizing the other party's rhetoric and signaling that she's going to be tough above all.
Though not her alone. They almost all said all options on the table, Edwards said.
Well,
Kucinich, certainly.
Except for Joe Biden, who said, listen, we can't have any make any progress with Iran until we take regime change off the table, which was the essential point, it seems to me. And so I think we did get a sense of those two.
There was still a lot of attention to these early months of the run-up to the war. Let's listen to Hillary Clinton talking about why she voted in 2002 to give President Bush the free hand on Iraq, essentially, and whether she did enough research in advance.
Do you regret voting to authorize the president to use force against Saddam Hussein in Iraq without actually reading the National Intelligence Estimate, the classified document laying out the best U.S. intelligence at that time?
Well, I was thoroughly briefed. I knew all the arguments. I knew all of what the Defense Department, the CIA, the State Department were all saying. And I sought out dissenting opinions as well as talking to people in previous administrations and outside experts. You know, that was a sincere vote based on my assessment that sending inspectors back into Iraq to determine once and for all whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and using coercive diplomacy was not an unreasonable act. What I did not count on, and what none of us did who voted to give the president authority, is that he had no intention to allow the inspectors to finish their job.
Ron Brownstein, is this Democratic contest going to be decided on the genesis of the war or on the way forward? Are we going to keep coming back to the origins or plans to, you know, move it now?
Excellent question. I think in the end, moving forward will be more important than looking back, although there is a portion, as I said, of the Democratic electorate that will not get past the fact that Hillary Clinton voted to authorize the use of force and has refused to say that it was a mistake. But I do think that the tenor of the debate is forcing the national debate, not only the debate inside the Democratic race, is forcing the candidates into a position that is closer and closer together in terms of what to do next. And that, in the long run, I think, does benefit Hillary Clinton, you know, who, as Jack said, I think it was Jack, that is running a kind of front-runner campaign that is aimed in many ways at minimizing difference and appealing – minimizing issue difference and appealing on a different framework. I mean, she is clearly benefiting from a sense that she is prepared to be president. When you look at the poll, she is overwhelming her rivals. It's kind of extraordinary. The first serious woman candidate leading these other all men significantly on that measure. And I think in these debates, that's what she does best. I mean, she looks very, very prepared. And you may find the answers too polished or too political. But there, I think she comes across as someone who is ready to be president. And that is, I think, one of the principal ways she wants to contrast herself with the other candidates.
Clear, simple, strong, sophisticated. I mean, she reflects that standing in the polls. I thought it was pretty impressive delivery last night, whatever you think of what's inside it. Let's go to listeners who were watching and listening. Mitch is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Mitch, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. I believe Obama came to very strongly last night. I think most of your commentators said it, not all of them, but most of them, especially about, again, the war in Iraq. I think as Obama stated last night, I mean, he opposed the war from the start. And actually, what I've read, I mean, he opposed the war before it even started. And I really did like the comeback by Senator Obama with John Edwards about opposing the war 4.5 years ago.
Mitch, contrast Obama and Clinton right next to him last night. Who looked to you more presidential?
Well, I think Obama did. I mean, and again, this the war in Iraq is to me the bread and butter issue here, and it's going to decide the election. You know, for the Democratic candidate between now and probably next February, March, and in the fall election in 2008. I think it's all about Iraq. I mean, all other issues are secondary. And I think last night, I mean, with Senator Obama, I mean, he's always supported legislation for timetables withdrawal. I mean, he introduced his own legislation.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you're solid on that bandwagon, and we've got it, Mitch. Let's get another call from Boston. Dan's on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what did you see?
Well, what interested me was that the more they talked about telling the truth and transparency, the more they obfuscated. And so at the end of the day, on the issues of genocide, clearly the Democrats have an opportunity to exercise some moral authority, not only with Darfur, but with Iraq, and then backed away, that they don't really tell the truth that it's a war geared to oil, and that as much as everybody would like to move all the troops out and home, the reality is that they can't really do that in the short haul, that there was a whole thing about the war and that the military is broken, which really brings up the issue of, are we going to share this war across the nation? Is there really going to be another draft? And again, they didn't take the moral opportunity. So it just seems to me that they're really skirting on the outside and doesn't give them the opportunity to really drive the opportunity.
Dan, we've got it. Eleanor Clift, what about this theme of truth and honesty? Well, huge, running through so many comments last night, but Dan says finally he doesn't hear it.
Well, I think there's a difference between protesting a war and legislating an end to the war. And I think Senator Biden tried to point out that to override a presidential veto would take 67 votes in the United States Senate. The Democrats have a bare 50 with one Senator Lieberman generally voting with the Republicans and another one out ill still with as a result of a brain hemorrhage. So the reality of the legislative arena is that this can't happen instantly. And I thought he made an effort to inject some truth. And I thought John F. Edwards is also trying to wear that mantle, not only on the war, but on taxes. And the point is that he's talking about raising taxes. Now, Hillary Clinton then jumps in. She was the peacemaker last night. Mm-hmm. But she has a vested interest in adopting everybody's position and dominating the field. But she pointed out that there isn't a Democrat on the stage that wouldn't let the Bush tax cuts for the rich lapse. Mm-hmm. So, you can see their electoral strategies. Mm-hmm. But I think what comes across if you're a voter is that, you know, there are at least three or four people up there who really are ready to be president. And I think Senator Obama delivered a strong performance. He has sort of a tentativeness about the way he speaks, but I think that's part of his appeal. He kind of goes for the larger philosophical issue, and it's refreshing in contrast to all of the blunt political points.
Yeah, Ron, what about Obama? I wondered at certain points last night whether his giant charisma fits into the quick pace of a debate like this. It takes him a little while to rev up. He's not quite as, you know, bang, bang, bang as the rest, but does it work anyway?
Well, the giant charisma isn't even always apparent on the stump. I mean, he's kind of a fascinating figure in that he has this kind of aura about him, and it's always good for a candidate when you kind of embody your message. I mean, mm-hmm. he sort of embodies his message of change. I mean, he clearly represents something very different in national leadership than we've ever seen in many dimensions. I mean, he was a community organizer. He's of mixed racial background. He's young. But as you say, I mean, it doesn't always come across in these settings. Having said that, I agree with Dan Baltz that he was much more effective than he was in the first debate where I thought he had real problems. And I think you saw his strengths yesterday, Sunday night, and I think that the overall, like I said, the overall, to me, the two big things that we saw in this debate was, again, I'm repeating Dan, you saw the frontier separate, in part because of the way they're being treated by the media, but also we see these strategies. Obama really is about change. Edwards really is about the agenda. Hillary Clinton really is about preparation. They are
when
selling
you say agenda and preparation. What do you mean, agenda preparation?
Well, I sort of said we have a candidate of preparation, of inspiration, and aspiration on mm-hmm. each side. A preparation. Hillary Clinton's, I think's argument is very clear that she is ready to be president on day one, and in these debates, I think she's doing a good job of reassuring Democratic voters or playing to her strength that she is capable of dealing with these issues. Edwards is aspiration. He has a very bold, he has agenda. He has a lot of goals. I mean, his basic argument relative to the other two is that I will give you more of what you want mm-hmm. if you are a Democratic-based voter on health care and energy, on the war. And then I think Obama very much is the inspiration, new generation of leadership. And of the three, he is probably having the hardest time squeezing his strength into the format of these debates, as you suggest.
At the same time, you've got the rest of the crew making some really interesting noises. Senator Joe Biden speaking very passionately last night about the need to use increased military force to end the genocide in Sudan. Here he is.
You have to stop talking about it. A lot of talk goes on about it. The United Nations has already said they're prepared to put in a 21,000 force, including the African Union. In fact, you have in the capital of Sudan, the government saying, we're not going to allow that to happen. They have forfeited their sovereignty by engaging in genocide. We should impose a no-fly zone. If the UN will not move now, we should impose a no-fly zone, and we should commit 2,500 NATO troops. You could take out the Janjaweed tomorrow.
Joe Biden last night, and there was electricity. You can't quite hear, but it was there in the hall last night when he said it. Let's go to Randy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi. I continue to be more and more impressed with Bill Richardson. He wasn't even on my radar screen anywhere at the beginning of this, but the more I listen to him, the more I read what he is about, his tremendous international experience, and then being governor of New Mexico, so he's had to go through the whole process of, working that out on the executive
but
level.
But, Randy, did you notice how hard it was for him to get a word in edgewise last night? Wolf Blitzer not coming to him that often and then not seeming that happy with the on-pointness of his answers when they came. I mean, he was cutting Richardson off again and again, and I thought Richardson was kind of fuzzy last night, Randy.
Well, I don't know. I think that he was clear about Darfur and about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And
he was talking to you. Let us listen to him for a second, and thanks for your call, Randy. Here's New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, the only Latino in the presidential race, on the immigration reform bill now being debated in Congress.
I would not support legislation that divided families. I would not support legislation that builds a wall, a Berlin-type wall between two countries, the way the bill in the Congress exists today. Now, what are the essential components of any good, sensible immigration bill? One, increase border patrols. Double the size of border patrols and technology. That makes sense. Don't reduce the National Guard that's there. Secondly, an earned legalization program. Yes, I support that. One that is based on learning English, paying back taxes, passing a background check, getting behind those that are trying to get here legally, obeying laws, embracing American values. And then lastly, finding ways that we penalize employers that knowingly hire illegal workers. That is essential in an immigration bill.
New Mexico Governor, when he finally got the microphone last night, Eleanor Clift, what did you think of Bill Richardson and the rest of beyond that trio that were seated right in the center of the hall last night?
Well, Bill Richardson has a lot to say, and whenever he had a turn, he tried to squeeze in as much of it as he could, and I think he himself got a little flustered than what he would get cut off. Chris Dodd is a very experienced senator. I think he had a harder time even than Bill Richardson getting into the debate. It's hard to see how these second, third-tier candidates can survive if the only format they really get is the debate, and they get so little attention in the debate. It seems to me that their tertiary status just gets reinforced.
Jack Beatty, Senator Dodd, very polished. But maybe not quite as close to the sort of hot heart of what was going on in his comments. Not quick and straight to it as some of the others.
No, I think it seemed to me he had a fatal case of Senate speak. I mean, you could just hear it there. And on Richardson, the voters want a governor. That seems to be what they've been doing. We've only had two senators as president. He's the only sitting governor in either field, and yet his persona and his performance so far lags his resume. I mean, you hear the resume and you expect something much more than what he seems to deliver on these occasions, and notably in a very poor Meet the Press show. So I really, with all due respect for Randy's question, I don't think the governor is going anywhere.
A lot of calls from Iowa today, and that's been in the news with regards to Hillary's campaign in particular. Let's go to Rita in Iowa City. Hi, Rita. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My point was that as a citizen of Iowa, and I reach out to New Hampshire too, we kind of have to do even more dirty work than just being couch potatoes listening to televised events.
Did it feel like dirty work to you last night, Rita?
Well, actually, my point was that the previous evening I was at a live function in Cedar Rapids with five of the candidates.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between watching even the televised performances, because for the most part they are performances, and going out and seeing these people up close and personal at live functions where you see the sweat beating on the brows.
Right. Lucky you. Who fares better live than on TV or the other way around, Rita?
I guess Hillary fares real well televised because she's performing. As a feminist, I was going, yay, Hillary. And then the more I saw her, the more I thought, this is very programmed and artificial.
Of course, that's the way most people will see her up close and personal. Who did you like best?
John Edwards. I'm a true believer at this point. He's inspiring. He's genuine. So honest. It's just heartwarming.
Yeah, that effectiveness in the courtroom, maybe working firsthand there as well. Rita, thanks for calling. Ron, what do you make of that? Hillary Clinton's campaign memos out last week saying maybe we shouldn't even be in the Iowa caucuses.
That call was fascinating because it really gets to the crux, I think, of what we're seeing here. Look, the individual exchanges in last night's debate are going to come and go, and I don't think anybody's going to remember them by the time people start voting. But here's the larger point.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing is a very clear kind of chicken and egg phenomenon in which the race is being tiered. And you have this message being sent out constantly by the media and by the fundraisers that here are the top tier of candidates, Edwards, Obama, and Clinton. Clearly, the debate last night was very much a reinforcement of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, historically, voters in Iowa and New Hampshire have done the tiering in the race. They've done the winnowing in the race. They've been willing to elevate candidates who were at minuscule numbers in the national polls. Jimmy Carter in 1976, George H.W. Bush in 1980, Gary Hart in 1984. Is it still going to be possible for someone who is seen as in the second tier to break through in Iowa and New Hampshire and make themselves into a national figure? Or is, in effect, the nationalizing of this race, something we've talked about before, taking that function away from those voters who are, in effect, going to choose only among the choices that the media has sanctioned as viable? And I think last night was kind of a very tangible manifestation of kind of an intangible change that I believe is transforming the way we pick our presidents.
We've got another Iowa listener thinking about just that. Catherine, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'm just wondering about the same thing. When we talk about first tier, second tier, third tier, already in June of 07, and like these three front runners, as we call them now, being together, and then other people, as you've talked about, second and third tier being cut off, that's a real problem because if the media keeps doing that, then the American people will not be informed about who our possible candidates are. And pretty soon, people who really are viable as candidates won't have a chance. And that's not what we need in this country.
Catherine, thanks for that. Eleanor Clift, how about it? Ron Brownstein says it's kind of a chicken and egg. I mean, the polls are also separating these candidates. It's not just the media.
It's also based on some reality. I mean, these, Chris Dodd, who's been in the Senate a long time, is going to have to find a way to distinguish himself from the rest of the field. He's trying to do that. He's come out early with a rather bold energy independence plan. Dennis Kucinich is sort of a fixture in these races. I don't think, he's never going to make it into the first tier. So I think there's some reality-based assessments here as well. Iowa will issue three tickets, win, place, and show. And conceivably, a Bill Richardson or a Joe Biden might get one of those places. But I think essentially we probably are looking at the formed field coming out of Iowa.
Let's go to Marilyn in Buffalo, New York. Marilyn, what do you see?
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Interestingly, I had been undecided, I think it's an excellent field of candidates. I did become decided after the debate last night.
Let's hear it.
And my decision was that I would support Hillary for president and Richardson for vice president.
Why Richardson in number two spot there?
I think Hillary has the better chance of becoming the candidate. And I think Richardson would just be a wonderful addition, given his tremendous experience in foreign policy.
Better than Obama? Better than Edwards at her side?
Yes, I had been sort of leaning toward Edwards, and I was less impressed with him last night.
And what about Hillary herself? How did she nail it for you last night, Marilyn?
She's just so good. I mean, she's so well prepared. She knows her stuff so well. I was also particularly impressed with something she did last week, I believe it was, after the terrible Supreme Court decision on discrimination claims, that she immediately sponsored legislation to try to overdo that decision.
Right, so she was right in on it. Marilyn, thanks for your call. Jack Meadey, what about Hillary last night? I also had the sense of all that preparation somehow coalescing in her debate persona last night pretty effectively.
Pretty effectively, but last week I watched Peter Hart do a focus group with voters in Towson, Maryland, independents, Republicans, Democrats. And he asked them, you know, which of these candidates in both parties has to do the most work for you to trust them to be president? Kind of, and it was almost unanimous, Hillary Clinton, that they're the one that she was the candidate who, at some basic level, these voters, even the Democrats, didn't trust. And it came out that they didn't trust her partly because of her husband. They didn't think he was trustworthy. But they also were sort of holding her achieved persona against her, as an earlier caller did, saying, well, she's prepared. She gives these good answers. But what does she really think? I don't know how much of this was just a sort of screen for sexist prejudices. I don't know how much of it was Bill Clinton. But I tell you what, it was a significant problem for her to see all those hands go up in the air. And I don't think her performance last night helped in that regard, because it brought up the whole issue. You know, we got into how she and why she voted as she did on the Iraq War, and how she did not look at the entire 90-page intelligence estimate, which, had she read it, might well have persuaded her not to vote for this disaster.
Ron, what about Hillary's strengths and weaknesses, how they're playing out here? And what about, I've got to ask, what about Barack Obama and John Edwards, both, you know, calling her Hillary repeatedly rather than Senator Clinton, as the men tended to address each other?
That was striking. Strengths and weaknesses are very different, I think, in a general election and a primary. I mean, her principal problem, I think, in a general election is that there is a substantial portion of the public that formed an impression of her in the early years of the Clinton administration, even during the campaign, the Tammy Wynette comment, the way health care played out, all of the scandals and pseudo-scandals that swirled around her. And the issue will be, I think, whether she can, if she is the nominee, whether she can convince them to give her a second look, or whether there is a big portion of the electorate that's fundamentally closed off to her. I think, in a strange way, that may also be the principal problem in the primary, because I think the best chance that the other candidates have of dethroning her will be not so much the assault from the left, the idea that she's not a sincere Democrat and she wasn't tough enough on the war. It will be that she is too risky a bet in a general election the Democrats feel is theirs to lose. So I think that the biggest weakness is sort of intertwined. And ultimately, I think that what could be the greatest threat to her would be a kind of dynamic that develops in which polling through the fall and as Iowa and New Hampshire approach show Obama and Edwards leading the major Republicans and her trailing. Now, I thought that was kind of striking, the informality there. Now, conversely, she tried to play leader of the pack and, in effect, used the we several times
not so much the royal we.
She said she was sort of speaking for the
group.
That's
true. Yeah.
Pushing back at Wolf Blitzer, pushing back at some of the questions. She wants to be seen, I think, as a figure who is big enough to unite the party.
You mentioned health care, and there was quite a bit on it last night. Senator John Edwards, Obama, Clinton, all speaking to it. Here's Senator Edwards talking about his health care plan, warning, again, this theme of honesty, that honesty is needed with the voters, and that reform will be expensive.
My plan costs $90 to $120 billion a year. I pay for it by getting rid of Bush's tax cuts for people who make over $200,000 a year. And I believe you cannot cover everybody in America, create a more efficient health care system, cover the cracks, you know, getting rid of things like pre-existing conditions and making sure that mental health is treated the same as physical health. I don't think you can do all those things for nothing.
Can't do it for nothing. Here's Senator Barack Obama laying out some principles for health care reform. He unveiled his proposal last week.
My emphasis is on driving down the costs, taking on the insurance companies, making sure that they are limited in the ability to extract profits and deny coverage. That we make sure the drug companies have to do what's right by their patients instead of simply hoarding their profits.
And then Senator Hillary Clinton, noting in the debate last night that she was glad the other Democrats were interested in universal health care, a proposal she famously supported and was defeated on as First Lady. Here, Hillary Clinton talks about the cost of her proposals.
I have put forth approximately $120 billion in savings from healthcare changes that can come, everything from electronic medical records to better management of chronic care. That is about in the ballpark of what all of us believe it will cost to cover everyone.
Eleanor Clift, how do you think voters will, should weigh these proposals flying around and the means of paying for them that the Democrats are putting out on the table?
Yeah, again, I think the differences are slivers of differences, and the voters will weigh it more in terms of character. And again, Edwards is the one who's saying this is going to cost money, and I'm willing to say that it's going to cost money. And I think, you know, Obama, by not making it mandatory for adults, only mandatory for children, is making the kind of philosophical point that he's famous for, that people don't buy health insurance because they're deliberately avoiding it. They just can't afford it. And if you make it affordable, they'll buy it. You don't have to require it. So I think those kind of character philosophical differences will fit into the candidates' various personas. But I can't see the voters basing their decision on, you know, whose plan covers more people.
But everybody says they're going to do something about it, of course.
Yeah, and I think we have reached the point in our society that I actually believe them. And whether it's a Democrat or a Republican who gets elected, Republicans, of course, aren't even talking about it really in the primaries. But I think whoever is in the Oval Office beginning in January 2009 is going to have to seriously contemplate a plan to expand coverage.
The pressure is certainly there, but it was fascinating, and she used it again, Hillary Clinton, rolling her eyes, remembering the pressures that come to bear in opposition to reform once it gets up on the rails and real. Let's go to Malone, New York. And Paul, hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Kucinich in the tradition of McGovern, in the tradition of Kennedy. We need a nice man who has the moral high ground to see that you do something about Darfur, in a way that Biden also said, that you do something immediately about getting out of Iraq, and that you don't play politics in the summer of 2002 when they're ramping up for this Iraq war, and the logical people of the world, all of Europe, most of the rest of the world, knows exactly what's going on here. We want our foot in the middle of the Middle East. We want it right on the second largest oil reserve in the world, and we're going to go in there and take care of this man. I want a man like Carter, who is Dennis Kucinich, a man who's gone all the way to seeing that just because we have the power doesn't mean we have to keep doing the easy thing and using it.
Easy, quote-unquote, Dennis Kucinich saying no entirely to even to war itself last night. Let's listen to just a little bit of Kucinich way out there on one of the wings, Senator Mike Gravel on the other. But here he had some of the most, fiery liberal positions last night. Here he is talking about his opposition to the Patriot Act.
The Patriot Act has undermined civil rights in this country. And as President of the United States, one of my first acts in office would be to move forward to have the Justice Department overturn the Patriot Act as unconstitutional.
Dennis Kucinich last night. Ron Brownstein, here he is. He's saying, what would he do, as soon as he got into office? Get out of the WTO, get out of NAFTA, go back to bilateral trade pacts and with labor and environmental demands, no to war. What's the role of Kucinich and, for that matter, Mike Gravel in these debates?
Well, you know, the presidential race has become a forum for elements of the party to try to redirect the national debate. We saw Gary Bauer run for the Republican presidential nomination in 2000 with no chance of winning as a voice of the Christian conservatives. And Dennis Kucinich serves that role for the Democratic left. There is a kind of value as a prod to the other candidates. These candidates can force the mainstream contenders to sharpen their opinions and to be more clear in their views. But ultimately, that's really what it is. It is a gadfly role. And, you know, I think it's frustrating to the sponsors of these debates. Certainly on the Republican side, it's been a problem having so many candidates out there who really have no chance of being the nominee by any conventional measure. So it's kind of a mix, but it does play this role, if nothing else, of pushing issues onto the agenda and forcing the leading candidates to deal with things that perhaps they wouldn't want to.
Jack, I've got to say it kept it interesting for me when Wolf Blitzer would turn to the guys, the wingmen there, Kucinich and Gravel, and they would bring very contrary adversarial positions to the table that just weren't getting articulated at the center of the stage.
Yeah, and I think when Dennis Kucinich said, you know, these people could stop to fund the war. That's how to get out of the war.
And don't even put a bill up. Just don't send the money.
That's right. And none of them want to take that position at all. And I thought Gravel's point was, well, yeah, gas prices are high, but you know what? If we're really serious about doing something on climate change, they've got to be even higher. It would seem to be his implication. So, which is again the brutal truth. So yeah, they're truth tellers, and I wish more could have been done on the follow up to a why won't you vote then to stop the war? You say you want it ended. You say you want to put timetables, but the real way the Constitution gives you is the power of the purse. Mm. Why aren't you exercising it, Mr. Obama, Ms. Clinton?
Eleanor Clift, long way to go here. We'll hear from Republicans midweek, but as Democrats look at that stage, here we are in June of 07. How good should they feel?
I think Democrats should feel good. The demographics of the next election strongly suggest the Democrat is going to win. And again, I think there are at least three, maybe four or five people who acquitted themselves very well on the stage last night and I think are going to do well throughout the race. And so, Democrats are not adrift the way the Republicans are.
Well, we're all watching and listening. Great to have each of you. Eleanor Clift with Newsweek, Ron Brownstein at the Los Angeles Times, and Jack Beatty. Thanks to each of you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.